Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Black Friday, business up about 16%. France is warned on their credit rating. Big week for economics coming up. And an update on the Spearman indicator. All this and our guest Ambrose Evans-Pritchard from the Daily Telegraph is going to be with us talking all about Europe from the insider's point of view. And we'll get into some of the things that are coming up that you need to know about. All this and more on episode number 240 for November 28th, 2011. Well, thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here, and we got lots to talk about in a very compressed time because I slotted a good amount of time for our guest because he has a good deal of depth, knowledge, and understanding about what's going on. And with all the things that have been said and a lot of the things that we've been hearing over the last week or so and month or so and year or so maybe, I think that some of that needs a little bit of clarification from the other side of the pond. We know what we think we hear over here, but, you know, we got to kind of, for a few moments, think about maybe it looks a little bit different from a different perspective over there, so to speak. We have a bunch of winners that we're going to be sending out some of the books from DOS, Extreme Money, if you remember that. And I wanted to touch base. Let me find it here. I have one of the jokes that I wanted to read out loud here. This is simple. And it was to the point, and I think that I thought it was really, I don't know, it was just kind of silly. This is from Steve N., and he writes, so there's a European summit, and afterwards the Italian, Spanish, and Greek finance ministers head out to a bar for some food and libation. They run up a huge tab. So who ends up paying the tab? You know, who ends up paying for the whole thing? Of course, the Germans. Anyway, we got a lot of other ones. You know, there's not much material to work with there, but we'll send out all your books for those that sent in some decent jokes, and we're going to send you out also, Steve, a copy of Extreme Money from DOS, and you'll be getting that very shortly in the mail. It's the hardcover, and I think you'll enjoy that very much. The other things, a couple of things I want to mention to you were a couple of follow-up issues that I think are really important, and then we'll talk about some Outlook issues. And it's been tough. Listen, I'm sure you are... Oh, if you're not disgusted or dismayed or even perturbed at this point with the volatility of the markets and the craziness when you see on one hand a decent economic number and maybe a decent earnings, but yet markets selling off, you know, what does our market have to do with Europe and what does Europe have to do with Asia and what does Asia have to do with this one? It's all interconnected, you know, and I think that right now, if you can try just for the moment to separate the emotions and the, you know, the feelings and kind of disgust from the markets from maybe just how to trade them, because this is a tradable market right now, and that's how we're actually looking at it through the end of the year probably, where you'll see a good amount of volatility and you'll see a good amount of profit taking. You'll see a lot of bottom fishing going on. And the best way to really deal with all this is to simply just go and realize that it doesn't have to make total sense, but if you want to trade the range and you want to utilize the power of the rallies and the sell-offs to your advantage, then it really would be a good idea to think about, you know, taking your foot off the gas for a little while and not consider just buying and holding, or for that matter, shorting and holding, and look at a better way of maybe managing your money from the perspective of a risk and reward scenario. So in our portfolios, what we do for clients in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, as an example, is what we do is, during times where we have a market trend indicator that is in a very strong downtrend, we will do a few things. First of all, we take money off the table that we've probably been doing for some time already. And right now we're down to a very small amount and actually net ever so slightly net short. And what you do is that you don't let your losers really start getting carried away, and you let your winners continue on and take some profits when possible. But what you also do is you'll enter into trades based on very supportive or very resistant levels in the markets. An example of that would be Friday. If you look at what happened last Friday, you saw that the markets traded up to their, first they traded down to some support about 1149 or so on the futures, and then they moved higher up to the 1170 range in the same day and then just sold right off. These are very defined areas that you can find, whether it's by using simple technical analysis and support resistant points or some of the things that we use here to gather where would be the best places to, you know, best probability to buy or to sell a market in a trading range, again, in a trading situation. So I think that you want to look at that, and I think that that's an important thing to consider. Stay on top of our website. We talked about the Spearman indicator. The Spearman indicator is one of these very, I think it's a pretty good indication of near-term oversold and overbought conditions in a market. We like it better for the oversold condition when things are just getting kind of really lousy. But when the Spearman indicator starts to launch higher, like it did at the end, probably Thursday, Friday of last week, there is an opportunity for a quick snapback rally, and that's a great opportunity to trade. Now, you don't want to necessarily get into it beforehand because these oversold and overbought conditions can last a long time, a lot longer than you would expect sometimes. But realize that when there is this kind of situation, you have to be ready to pounce. So what you want to do is when you see the bounce start to move and start to hold with a decent amount of volume, maybe what you want to do is start adding to a long position till you see that turn, till the overbought situation becomes into play, or until at least you get a little bit higher on the oversold. So from an oversold of a negative 70, you go to maybe a plus 10. Now you could say, well, why wouldn't I want to ride it out from there? Well, the problem is we're still in a very vicious downtrend with very, very, very bad news that has been coming out on a regular basis. So that being the case, you want to be careful of getting in the mentality of I'll trade this up to a certain point, wherever that resistance is, and then I'll maybe short it on the other side. So take a look at that Spearman indicator we put up last week. I think on Friday it was. And it was really kind of, if you look at the chart and you look at the dynamics of the chart, how it really operates, you'll see that there is this kind of oscillation. And when it happens to get really oversold, like the McClellan oscillator, which is also in the same position, those are certain sort of times that are really kind of interesting to look at. I would start looking at, and we are looking at, an entry point for TNA, which is the triple long small cap. Also, maybe the double or triple large cap. Those are things to look at. And you can start looking at maybe, just maybe, getting long the banks again. On DH Unplugged about 2 weeks ago, we recommended getting short the banks through a triple inverse ETF. And that's done very well. I think it's about 25% since we recommended that. Or didn't recommend it. We really talked about it as one of the play positions in this portfolio that we run. All for fun. There is a big week for Eco coming up, and a lot of that's going to be on the heels of this Black Friday number. Now, I want to take just a moment, and I want you to consider something with me. Black Friday, they say, was pretty good. You know, there's a lot of mixed indications initially, and there was a kind of question of how well is this really going to do, and are we going to see this great, great movement of people buying and pent-up demand that comes in, or are we going to see this, wow, look what's going on around the world, and people really just saying, forget this. Well, so far, the numbers that are coming up from the official indications are about a 16% increase in spending since last year. Now, that sounds great, but I just, always a skeptic. I want to just understand what they're talking about, because it's my understanding that Black Friday really became more like a Black Thursday, and a lot of stores had sales that were really started on Thursday night and, Friday. Some stores were actually open on Thursday. So the question is, this is kind of like the cash for clunker situation where we said, okay, that's great. They're buying all these cars, but what's going to happen in the future? And what we did see was, absolutely, that we were really borrowing from the future by buying things up front now. So now if, in fact, shoppers went out in force on Thursday and into Friday, and they had a lot more hours to shop. Is it possible that some of the numbers that we're seeing right now are simply the excess hours that were out there that are going to pull from the future? You understand what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that did the people kind of go out now and early spend the money that they would spend over time? And what we're going to see is that maybe the entire season isn't as spectacular as we think it would be based on solely the Black Friday numbers. This is something that's going to play out. I think you'll see some news about this, but I don't know if there's really any way to really project this, but maybe I can get somebody on the podcast, but by then it may be too late, you know, a week from now. But we will at least ponder this question, and I want you to do the same. I mentioned there's a big week for Eco coming up. You have the NFP payrolls coming up. You have some ISM manufacturing numbers coming up. You have some China numbers coming up. You clearly have some European numbers coming up. So you're going to see the continuation. But clearly in the U.S., there is a very, very condensed and quite a significant amount of information coming out early in the week. You'll see, this is the standard, you'll see the housing numbers, the Case-Shiller housing numbers. They'll come out on Tuesday, as well as the consumer confidence number. You're going to see Wednesday the numbers for private payrolls. You're going to see on Thursday initial claims. And Friday the NFP numbers, unemployment rate, unofficial employment rate, all of that's coming out. So realize that's all going to be there as well. Finally, I want to mention that one of the things that we are fearing is the downgrade of France due to the whole way the EFSF was structured, the Financial Stability Fund that was structured in order to help out various countries. Already, it looks like Italy is going to be requiring a very significant amount of money. Their borrowing costs have gone up dramatically. But, you know, if France gets downgraded, and I talked about this, and as a matter of fact, I'll talk and I'll ask, I should say, Ambrose about this in a little while. You know, I think that the whole EFSF is going to be in big trouble and realize that there's not a lot of people that are going to be buying in. Look what happened to Germany last week with their auction. Germany's auction was horrible. I mean, just horrible. There was nobody knocking on their door saying, hey, we want it under any situation. No. As a matter of fact, they didn't sell close to, I think, a third of the bonds that they were planning on because demand was so light. So I think when we look at the week to come, there's a couple of things you have. You have, which, let me back up. We don't really subscribe to the whole overbought, oversold. It's too very basic to really come up with that. There's no real number there. But I will tell you that when we see certain positions of indicators, whether you want to call it oversold or overbought, or you want to call it the indicator alert number, the fact is that the Spearman, the McClellan, and a few others are really showing that, well, there could be some contrarian flow coming into the markets as soon as probably Monday or Tuesday of this week. Now, I'll back that up with also saying that it's the last week of the month. You also have this consumer confidence and NFP numbers coming out at the end of the week. So while it's only a few days left in the month, it may be a good chance to see a short covering rally into the end, take profits, and maybe reset up. But also you have the potential of a lot of pent-up buying demand that just hasn't been there. Volume has been light, and I think overall there's going to be a little bit of a rally coming up, and then we're going to see how that plays out dependent on the economics and the noise out of Europe. So that is something I want you to be aware of next week, that we are looking at more of a longer exposure from where we are, and especially when you look at the performance of the markets over the last few weeks have been just terrible. And a lot of bottom fishers right now, performance chasers, are going to be picking up on that. Finally, I mentioned I was actually a guest on Frank Curzio's podcast this week. Go check that out. It's over at iTunes. And just look up Frank Curzio, look up me, you'll find that. I thought it was a pretty good interview, actually. I was really enjoyed our time together. And I think it's something you should really take a listen to. I also mentioned, finally, before we get to our guest, that this podcast, this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, is sponsored by GoToMeeting. Yes, GoToMeeting. You love them. I love them. Wonderful place to go when you want to really have a very interactive experience and share your screen, share the information, have a meeting that is virtual but yet feels like you're really there. Because it's simple. You just dial in and you call and you speak. And then at the same time, you're looking at the same information on your screen, or maybe you're sharing the screen, or you're possibly even doing things like sharing documents. There's a whole host of things that you can actually do with GoToMeeting. And what's nice about it is it's very cost efficient. It is actually one of those easy to understand, easy to navigate, and very, very, very plain to understand for anybody, even if they're not technology-oriented, technically inclined, so to speak. So I want you to go check out GoToMeeting because I think you'll really enjoy what it is, and because it's 30 days for free, so why not? So go to GoToMeeting.com, enter the promo code podcast, and I think that you'll be on your way for 30 days of unlimited use of the service. And just check it out. If you don't like it, hey, that's great. But if you do, wow, you just found something that could really benefit you. GoToMeeting.com and put in the promo code podcast. So how about we get right to our guest, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, is with the international business editor of the Daily Telegraph. He's covered world politics and economies and all things financial for 30 years, based in Europe, the U.S., and Latin America. And he joined the Telegraph in 1991, and he serves as a Washington correspondent and later a European correspondent in Brussels. So this is a guy that really has, if you read his work, especially his finger on the pulse of what's going on and close enough to really, I guess, get burned by some of the fire, right?
Well, it's getting pretty intense right now in Europe because we're getting to the final end game of this whole experiment, and they have to resolve it one way or another. And journalists are getting a lot of heat, too, for, you know, reporting the negative news.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that.
No, but I mean, it's coming, you know, they're getting pretty frantic. They're trying to censor the rating agencies. I mean, you know, we've all got our quarrel with how the rating agencies behave, you know, in the lead up to the subprime crisis in the U.S., but the problem right now is that they're essentially engaging financial repression to stop them reporting on European sovereign states.
Yeah.
They don't like what the agencies are saying, and they're saying it's feeding the crisis. But the trouble is that there's a fine line here. If you start saying, well, it's just opinion, you know, all they're doing is expressing an opinion. If you're saying, well, you can't express an opinion any longer, then it's not long before you start telling the press that as well. This is the problem here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll take it one step further, I think. There has been, particularly from Europe, now I can, we're focusing on that for a second. There's other pockets, but I have this thing where the amount of, I'll call it either politically structured or well-planted, or, you know, the news that comes out with anonymous sourcing. You know, years ago, I don't know how it was over there, but years ago, there was a requirement to have at least two sources in a newsprint article and usually opposing opinions. And then on top of that, you would have to get it vetted by an editor of some sort, right? Now it's like the race to get it on paper or on the internet. So these anonymous or these sources that seem to be close to wherever it is are utilized, and oftentimes, it turns out to be questionable information, don't you think?
Well, let me just say two things here. I mean, firstly, the news standards of the great American papers is higher than the European papers.
Mm.
I mean, you know, it's the Columbia School of Journalism doctrine and so forth. I mean, it's just they're more rigorous, and that's been the tradition for quite a long time. There's a particular problem in Europe when you got the EU summits and you've got all these countries disagreeing with each other and institutions disagreeing with each other, the European Commission, the European Council, you know, there's the German position, there's the Spanish position, there's the French position. Everybody's leaking behind the scenes. Everybody's briefing. They're trying to influence the outcome. They're sort of planting stories. You don't know where things are coming from. You get this utter confusion.
Right.
This happens, you know, you build up to every single summit. It's inherent in the way the EU works. It's all done behind closed doors. All these summits in which, you know, it's never open. You get stitch-ups, cook-ups in advance. You get things done. You know, it's very difficult. I mean, I've covered up 30 or 40 of these wretched summits over the years. And it's always absolute chaos because you don't quite know what's going on. It's in the corridors. It's the way the EU does business, and it's fundamentally, you know, warped, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, this is why they shouldn't, you know, they've taken away essentially the prerogatives and powers from the nation states, and the democracies of Europe are anchored in the ancient states, like Britain and France and so forth. You know, and once you transfer it to this sort of all these powers, to this sort of body that doesn't have any proper democratic accountability, you get endless problems. It's simply dysfunctional political system, and the euro is a dysfunctional economic sort of creation of that system.
Yeah, I've always thought, and you feel way back, and anything I've ever talked about, I always scratched my head about the euro and said, I just don't get it. Wait, I'm talking way back. You know, saying, how in the world is this going to happen? But that's water under the bridge. We all know that this is obviously the end product of what's going on. But I think more so, you're right, between the IMF, the EU, you can just talk about that, the ECB, and then you have the IIF. And it goes on and on and on. And in the end of the day, I think one of my most interesting things that happened recently that I saw was that Greece comes in and says, hey, you know, we're not going to sign that document for that $100 billion because, you know what, our word is good enough. Don't you see all the things we've done? We're going to, you know, come on, what are you talking about? And then meanwhile, a couple of days later, they're going, at least the rumors and the discussion on Friday was that they're going behind the scenes and looking for 75% haircuts behind the backs of the parties that were really going and providing them the bailouts, and they're going right to the creditors. I mean, these are kind of, how do you trust these people?
Well, let me just say, firstly, you know, on the point of why did they launch the euro? You know, they were warned back in the early 90s and in the mid 90s by their own economists in the European Commission, by the Bundesbank in Germany, by the professionals, that this wasn't going to work as constructed. You needed a European Treasury. You needed some kind of, you know, equivalent of the U.S. Treasury behind it. You know, a debt pool, all the structures of a federal state, of a super state. You needed a fiscal union, blah, blah, blah. And unless you had that, it's going to be extremely difficult ever to make this thing work. And their view was, at least some of the people behind this project, Jack Delors, for example, who was commission president, is, well, great, we have a crisis. And then when we have the crisis, that allows us to, you know, have the great leap forward to the European integration that we want, the kind of, you know, the ideologues of this whole project, they wanted, they couldn't get otherwise. In other words, the sovereign states would be forced to give up sovereignty to make the currency work. And so it's almost a sort of gamble that, okay, we don't care if there's going to be a crisis because we'll use it. It'll be a beneficial crisis. We'll take advantage of it. And so it's now happened. We're now right at that moment. And suddenly, it's not actually clear that they're going to get the great leap forward.
I'd be hard-pressed to understand how they're going to get that, because the member states, even the ones that are having the most difficult times, don't want to be under common control. They don't want to have these folks, you know, putting their noses into their books.
Well, I mean there are a number of problems here. Yeah. Firstly, to make this work, you have to have, at this point, because we're right into a kind of dire systemic crisis, two things have to happen immediately, and they both depend on Germany. You have to move to debt mutualization, joint debt issuance along the lines of U.S. treasuries, instead of have, you know, European treasuries backed by everybody, and a full debt union, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you need the European Central Bank to step in as a lender of last resort, as the Federal Reserve has done, as the, you know, the Bank of Japan has done, the Bank of England has done, the Swiss National Bank has done. They've got to behave, you know, like a sovereign central bank, and just do it, whatever it takes, because you can't allow, you know, the sovereign states that make up the system to simply disintegrate and spiral into, you know, that's the crucial set of steps. But the trouble is, you know, firstly, the Germans were told when they gave up the D-mark, they were never given a vote, they were never given a referendum on it. It was just a sort of done deal. And they were told, well, you know, you'll learn to love it. the polls showed the majority of Germans were either against it outright or very, very skeptical about it. But they were promised that this would never lead to a crisis. And in fact, famously, one of the Bavarian leaders said, there'll be more chance of famine in Bavaria than that we should ever have to bail out one of the southern states. All this is now being thrown back in the faces of the politicians, of course.
Right.
And so that there's massive sort of hostility in Germany to going any further, creating euro bonds, giving up their own credit rating, taking on the debts of all these countries, you know, man, colossal debts of countries which, in their view, you know, support a welfare state and a pension system that they themselves don't have in Germany. And why should some, Deutsche Bank steel worker, hack it up at the age of 60, 69, you know, to pay pensions of somebody, you know, in a country where they retire in their mid-50s? You know, it's very hard sell to do that. And secondly, of course, and this is absolutely crucial, it's not understood, even in Europe it's not properly understood, is that the German Constitutional Court has ruled you can't do these things. You can't go to the next step because it violates the German Constitution, which is a sacrosanct document. It's been the foundation of Germany's post-war success as a free, liberal democracy anchored in the rule of law. It was actually designed by to a great extent, by the United States. And as was their monetary system, by the way, as was the Bundesbank. You know, the American officials played a crucial role.
It was the rebuilding process after the whole, you know, the whole downfall and all that.
It was a tremendous success, and the Germans are very grateful.
Now, here's the thing, though. But I mean, Merkel comes out and says no Eurobonds, and pretty much, although you never know, tomorrow it could change the way things go around here.
Yeah.
But says no Euro, it's just not happening. You know, ECB will not be the lender of last resort. Has been discussed many a times, but yet you see it sometimes. You know that there was a ruling, if you remember, from the EFSF that there would be no buying of sovereign debt in there. Remember that whole thing?
And then they did it. I mean, on the point of the constitutional, the German Constitutional Court, they ruled in early September. All the bailout stuff was challenged, by the way.
Yeah.
So they had to rule on it. And their ruling is absolutely clear. They said the sovereign powers of the German Bundestag, to tax and spend, you know, the issue upon which the English Civil War was fought in the 17th century, the issue in which the American Revolution was fought a century later, these powers are absolutely the foundation of German democracy, and they cannot be alienated to any foreign body or supranational body. In other words, the head of the court said, if Germany wants to go to some kind of euro bonds and a debt union with Europe and a full fiscal union, fine. But then you need a new constitution. Then you need to basically abolish Germany, create Germany is a province of the new European superstate. You can do that. You're going to have to write a new constitution, and you're going to have to take it to the people, and have a vote, and you're going to have to go through the whole procedure of changing the German constitution. Incredibly difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
And of course, Merkel knows she cannot possibly do that, because if she tried to take it to the people, it would just be blasted out of the water. And so she's completely paralyzed.
Yeah, no, so I mean, it's terrible.
This great calculation they made, the clever European, you know, elites back, you know, 15, 20 years ago when they launched this project that Germany would eventually yield, they didn't think about this particular problem.
Yeah, well, unfortunate. You know, you're pretty, I don't think you're, let's put it this way, from the things I read, and especially the headlines, you don't hold back. Let me just give people some of the recent headlines that you've recently written over at the Telegraph. It's America and China must crush Germany into submission. That's a pretty
Germany was being particularly annoying. By the way, I'm pretty pro-German. It's just that they were being, you know, completely militant about doing anything. They're not resolving the problem on any front. Which is, you can do a number of things at this point. You can do this. You can do the great leap forward to a European superstate and change the German constitution and bite the bullet, or you can organize an orderly breakup of the euro.
Right, which is
that's another way out.
Yeah, but there's no real orderly.
Well, there are degrees of orderly, and what they're going to do right now and the way we're heading at the moment. If we're going to have a completely catastrophic chain reaction, they're going to blast out the weaker countries, starting with Greece. That will as soon as that happens, and the investors already suspect this kind of thing's going on. You know, Portugal will get engulfed almost immediately because it's in just as bad state. In some respects, worse. Mm-hmm. It'll then become completely impossible to contain, and one by one, these countries will get blown out. There'll be catastrophic bankruptcies. Their banking systems will disintegrate. And you get the massive losses through the whole European banking system, which, by the way, is fantastically leveraged. They're much more leveraged than the American banks.
Yep.
Their loan-to-deposit ratios are 1.2, and America's 0.7.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, people talk about the American banks and the Anglo-Saxon finance being responsible. That's ridiculous. The European banks have much bigger liabilities and much more leverage. They're global in scale. I mean, they account for sort of 90% of all the cross-border loans in Eastern Europe and, you know, and 60% in Latin America, even more than the Americans. I mean, they are massively over-leveraged, and if this blows up internally in Europe, it just takes the whole world down with it, straight into a great
depression. Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that our banks are in bad shape, but I think that the reason that our banks here in the United States are in bad shape is, yes, we had all the problems and we had the bad loans on the books and all that, but it's also really the amount of European things, we'll call it, that are owned in those banks right now that are creating the additional problems right now.
Well, I mean, the European banks have $3 trillion of assets and liabilities in the United States.
Yep.
And the Fed's very worried about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Treasury's very worried about it because, you know, particularly the French, you know, they borrowed very heavily in the U.S. money markets in order to, you know, to do lending and investments in the United States. But they're essentially, if this thing starts imploding and they happen to sort of pull back out of the country, I mean, it creates a major, major headache for the U.S. I mean, the interlinkages are just enormous.
Well, this is the problem with taking their time with it, because it's giving us... I'm talking about the U.S. I'm talking about anybody ex-Europe for a second, okay? It's giving everybody around the world the time to kind of go out there and just, you know, pull back. I mean, you look at how much money that money markets pulled back over the last several months. You know, if you made something happen very quickly, whether it was painful or not, there would be a spreading of the suffering. But what's happening is the amount of time that they're allowing this to happen, it's creating kind of a slow-motion pitch that's easy to hit.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's quite awful because, you know, anybody sophisticated who kind of, and in the financial markets and so forth, they can sort of see what's happening, and it's just watching a slow train wreck in slow motion. It's just, and it's incredibly frustrating. And when I wrote that headline, by the way, it was a blog I knocked off in 20 minutes. I was late for lunch, and they came and said, "Can't you do a blog on this?" I said, "Okay." So I just knocked it off rather fast. Like, perhaps I shouldn't have put that headline on.
That was good. I liked it.
But anyway, the point is, my point was that the mishandling of this by the European leaders is not just an internal matter for Europe. It has global consequences. And at some point, if they prove incapable of solving it, the big boys have to move in and take over, and somebody has to lead the world. And the only two people who can lead the world right now are the President of the United States and the President of China.
Ugh.
And the G2 get together as the two dominant superpowers, and they simply impose order. You have to do it because you cannot have the world just disintegrating in this form. It's just too big an issue. And unfortunately, getting back to the earlier point, what do you do if they're not willing to, you know, let the European Central Bank operate as a genuine lender of last resort, which in my view actually could do? I think that these are rather, a lot of these legal objections to it are somewhat strained, and I think the Germans are actually right now cherry picking legal articles, legal, you know, treaty clauses, in order to avoid having to do it. When in fact there are treaties. You know, you can interpret the treaties in different ways if you want to, and eventually I think they will, because I think that's the only, it'll have to happen.
Right.
Or my view has been for some time that if Germany really can't stomach any of this, and same with the Netherlands, and the same with Finland, and these other, you know, AAA creditor states, then they should leave the euro. They should leave the euro.
Right.
Because that's the only way you could have an orderly breakup. If the weak states, you know, are forced out, you get an utter disaster. If the strong states leave, well, they don't suddenly have a run on their currency. If the currencies actually appreciate the new currency, they would get some investors in all their debt would get a windfall gain.
But they'll have a problem with their exports. That's the issue.
Well, they'll have a lot of trouble for their exports. But the southern countries would suddenly get the devaluation that they really need.
Mm-hmm.
Because of all the current account deficits, which is the basic cause of all of this, they've got trade deficits. This would help correct that, and they're 20-30% overvalued within monetary union.
Yeah.
So that would allow them to get back to equilibrium without having to go through 30% grinding debt deflation, for 20 years.
Yeah.
Which is untenable politically and socially, and probably economically as well. And that, and they would have all their contracts in euros would still be intact.
Right. Let me ask you this.
They wouldn't need to default. You would then no longer need to have this chain of defaults because they would be able to meet their obligations. The one great snag to this is suddenly the whole North European banking system would have roughly 7 or 8 trillion euros of debt in Southern Europe on their books would suddenly take a 30% paper loss, and they'd be in big trouble. So you'd have to recapitalize the northern banks, and so the governments would have to nationalize the banking system. So Germany would have to nationalize the German banking system, the Dutch would have to nationalize the Dutch banking system. Oh, well, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to do it cheap at the price compared to what else is going on.
But when I'm
saying you've got to bite the bullet and do something, that there are things that can be done, all of which are going to be very painful. But what you can't do is just drift on in the way we're doing right now.
Well, a couple of things. I talk to a lot of very smart people, I think, a lot of people domestically and internationally, and it seems that there's a lot of really, I'm not kidding about this, really very not only logical, but somewhat plainly seen by most people that this is what you have to do. And I'm just totally perplexed about how the government there, unless it is such an incredible bureaucracy between all of the players, and they're all vying for their own interests only versus the team. If why they just can't get something done? It's really very hard for me.
Well, first of all, there's no government.
Right, I understand that.
And secondly, there's no shared view of what the problem is. You see, the narrative in Northern Europe, the German narrative, the Dutch narrative, about everything it went wrong because lazy Southerners didn't work hard enough, and they lived beyond their means, and run bloated pension welfare systems, and these feckless Greco-Latins, and they need to pull their socks up.
Mm-hmm.
That's their narrative.
Right.
Now, you can turn this around completely and say actually the real story is the opposite, that northern creditor powers, like Germany, have run a predatory trade policy in which they've locked in a permanent structural advantage in competitiveness, flooded Southern Europe with cheap goods that have undercut the industries of those countries, and hollowed out the industries of Italy and Spain and so forth. And now they're trying to prevent this being corrected in any way. That's the alternative story. Now, who's right here?
I think there's a little bit of both going on, just to let you know.
It's both. But the essential problem in all of this is not, let me make a point. It's often misunderstood here. The Greeks did pay very badly, and they lied about their deficit figures, the debt figures. They break every rule and so forth. But Spain did not. Spain never broke any of the rules and the deficit rules. Nor did Ireland. They ran surpluses all through those years. They did 2003 to 2007, that kind of period. They were running big budget surpluses. They were the saints. They were getting praised by the EU authorities for being model pupils. And actually, it was Germany and France at that point that broke the famous stability pact, which is a deficit ceiling of 3% of GDP. So it's not true that those countries they got into trouble because they were breaking rules. They got into trouble because they should never have been in the same currency as Germany in the first place.
Yeah.
The interest rate structure set by the ECB was incompatible for the two parts of the system. Fast-growing catch-up economies like Spain and Ireland at that point needed a much higher interest rate. And instead, when they joined EMU, when they joined the euro, their interest rates collapsed. In case of Portugal, it collapsed from 16% to 3% in a very short period, the interest rates. Well, can you imagine what would happen if American rates sort of fell that low? You just have people go completely bananas. You have a credit bubble, housing bubble.
Which is what happened. I mean, exactly. Spain and Portugal are two housing bubbles that just were horrible. The old question is, if you can get money loaned to you at 1%, 0.5%, no percent, how much do you get? All of it.
And the result was actually in Spain, for example, all through those years, the interest rate was actually negative in real terms. It was -2 on average for quite an extended period. The inflation was 4%. The interest rates were 2%. They'd been used to interest rates of sort of 10%. So, suddenly it was just, it was free money. The Bank of Spain, the Central Bank of Spain, did what was heroic. It was probably the most disciplined central bank in the world at that point, trying to fight the consequences of this. But they couldn't. They'd just been flooded with German and Dutch capital. They couldn't. There was nothing they could do to stop it. They tried. And maybe they could have done a little bit more in the end of the housing regulation. It was just impossible. The problem was flood of capital came in to stabilize these economies across southern Europe. They had different productivity growth rates, different sensitivity to interest rates, different wage bargaining systems. I mean, you go on. And they were completely incompatible because they didn't, none of the convergence you needed to make this whole experiment of monetary union work was in place. Mm-hmm. You had sovereign states, nation states with completely different structures and histories just bung together before they converged. I've been warning, when this began, and so did a whole lot of other people, this was completely irresponsible and was going to end badly. And you had this disguise for a while when the moment they locked the currencies together and you launched the thing, it looked okay. And then gradually each year you saw the inevitable divergences getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're falling apart. And, Italy has lost 40% in unit labor cost competitiveness against Germany since the currencies were locked together. 40%.
Some it's ridiculous, 50%. Right.
And that's because Germany actually compressed wages. In 2005, Germany actually, unit labor costs in Germany actually fell 4.5% in 1 year. They were squeezing wages. Productivity was rising very fast. It was in the meantime, Italy was just sort of plodding along, and unions were quite powerful. Wage increases were creeping up quite fast. Bit of inflation because they're always used to inflation. And things didn't converge at all. They're in the opposite directions. And so, at the end of the day, you've got such a big gap. You cannot close that anymore by simply getting these countries to go engage in austerity. Mm-hmm. And I might add, in the case of Italy, we talked about Spain and Ireland before. Italy has been running a primary budget surplus in surplus for the last 4 or 5 years. Over the last year or two, it's had the best fiscal profile of any major country in the G7.
But they do have a lot of debt. They have a tremendous debt.
They got a lot of public debt.
Yeah,
120% GDP, but they've got very low private debt.
Right,
and the aggregate two together, which is what we now look at, because it turns out that all these private debt seem to land on the shoulders of the state soon enough.
Right.
It's actually very low. It's about 250, which is one of the lowest in the developed world.
Right. So, what is your biggest fear? Let me just tell you what mine is. I have two questions for you. First of all, I need to know from your perspective why the euro, the currency, has been so resilient considering all the things that are happening. And secondly, what is your biggest fear? Mine, and this goes back to the discussion we had of the rating agencies. Mine is France losing their AAA rating. And I've been, what's your problem with France? There's a lot of problem with France losing their rating, in my opinion. And I also believe, and maybe this is a little crazy and harebrained, that the rating agencies are being quite kind right now by not downgrading France.
Well, why is the euro strong? Or has it held up?
Yep.
Very simple, because the emerging China and the emerging reserve powers of the developing world in Asia and the Middle East oil states felt they had too much of the money in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the last 6, 7, 8 years, they've accumulated $10 trillion of reserves globally, the central banks. China's accumulated $3 trillion alone. And they've been putting a large part of the new money. They haven't been selling their dollars, but they've been putting part of the new money into euros, because that would seem to be the only other kind of reserve currency that was big enough and liquid enough and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
They put a little bit in sterling and didn't like the yen. So we basically went into the euro. And so, it's, by general estimates, a third of China's reserves are now in the euro. So you talk about $1 trillion, about over $1 trillion. Russia's, I think, it's more like half actually now.
Wow.
Another $200 billion there. So you had these huge buyers in the market just coming in for strategic reasons, just buying euro without really looking at the details. I think from what I understand right now is one of the reasons why, even Germany had a failed auction last week.
Mm-hmm.
Even Germany,
right?
The anchor currency,
mm-hmm.
Is because not even the Central Bank of China is willing to buy German bunds anymore. I mean, they stopped buying Italian and Spanish debt some time ago, I think.
Yeah, because what happens?
They continue to buy the euro, but they buy the AAAs. They buy France and the Netherlands and Germany. But now they're not even willing to buy any of it. In other words, instead of rotating from the south into northern Europe, within the euro system that is getting out altogether, because people just look at this and they say, I don't understand how this works. This is dysfunctional. Who's in charge? They're all arguing with each other. We had an extraordinary event last week where the head of the European Commission produces this paper, Barroso, saying, calling for Eurobonds.
Yep.
And the German Chancellor shoots it down instantly as saying, extraordinarily inappropriate, she said. And if you're a Japanese investor,
right,
or a Chinese investor, and you look at this and you say, well, head of the European Commission's just proposed Eurobonds, and the Chancellor of Germany said it's extraordinarily inappropriate, you know, within 2 hours, what are you supposed to think about it? And you simply say, I don't understand what's going on here anymore.
Yeah. They've
had, you know, sort of 17 or 18 meetings and, you know, crisis meetings in 18 months. They haven't solved anything. Every deal they come to lasts 48 hours before it disintegrates. It's just, I just don't know why I'm getting out. And that's been the...
Yep. But they do eat well. They do eat well at those meetings.
Sometimes they go on so long. I covered the Lease Treaty in 2000 down in France, and it went on for 5.5 days. And we ran out of food, literally, and we were in this great big bunker. I became absolutely desperate. And finally, at 4:18 in the morning, they finally reached an agreement. And it was absurd the way in which they did it, too.
Well, that's what it is. It's all timed on how much food is. That's what it is. You we're here, we'll develop a plan around how much food we actually have to eat.
I mean, basically, you run out of food, you finally make a decision. But it's usually not made of the best circumstances. On France, everybody knows that when S&P downgraded the United States, they had to downgrade France because on any kind of, you know, they included in the downgrading of America, they included all the sort of pension liabilities. And, you know, they made a big picture assessment. It wasn't just the federal public debt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to use the same methods, France is worse.
Right, I agree.
And furthermore, France has all these massive contingent liabilities for the bailout fund, and it's supposed to be, you know, bailing out Italy and Spain.
Right.
Potentially colossal costs, which have, you know, furthermore, you know, it's questionable whether it should even be, you know, it should have maybe a 2 or 3 notch downgrade.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the S&P said in a report not long ago, they said that if the Eurozone went back into recession, they would do a lot of downgrades across the board, and probably 2 notches, and France would be one of the countries. Well, we're in a recession already. I mean, it was an unnecessary recession. It was caused by bad policy blunders, in my opinion, combined fiscal and monetary contraction simultaneously.
Right.
Do you think that... impose all this austerity on the southern states. All in combination now. We've now got two-thirds of the Eurozone all in synchronized fiscal contraction, in some cases quite violent fiscal contraction. And then the European Central Bank, instead of at least coming in and offsetting that with some form of loosening, raised rates in July into an oil spike. Exactly what they did in 2008.
That was insane, by the way. That was totally insane.
Well, in most central banks around the world, and most economists would say, you know, when you get a temporary commodity spike, you look through that, you look beyond it. You don't, because actually deflation is taking money out of people's, you know,
right,
taking money out of people's pocketbooks.
Yeah.
So it's really got a deflation effect. You don't start raising rates into this simply because your headline inflation rate is going up. I mean, that's so primitive, it's just ridiculous. But they did. They did it in 2008. They did it again the last July. It was absurd. I look at the money aggregates quite closely. You know, real M1 deposits were already collapsing across Southern Europe at a really vicious speed. You know, from probably late spring already, you know, sort of 7% annualized contraction rates, places like Italy,
mm-hmm,
even more in Portugal. They were even beginning to contract in France and Germany. So to raise rates in that situation when you've got all the money aggregates flashing these warning signs already, anyway, that's another story.
Yeah,
the point is that they had both of the two levers of economic power on contractionary settings. They made this the double dip downturn much more severe.
Right.
The argument now is it going to be a light recession, or is it actually going to be a really, really nasty second recession.
Now the talk is all about that, you know, the bad depression back in the 30s didn't start until a European bank failed. But that's a whole, you know, now you have to draw all these kind of things so that the, you
well,
know.
I think that's a very good parallel. I mean, you know, what happened in the, you know, in summer of 1931, when actually, it's a very interesting parallel because it was a dispute between France and Germany.
Naturally.
That led to the collapse of Anschluss. Anschluss. Freudian slip there. you know, and it was all to do with who was going to control Austria and would it be a backdoor way for Germany to get control of Austria. So the French blocked it. They blocked any rescue plan. Anyway, you know, Credit Anstalt collapsed, and we know what happened next. It just ricocheted straight through the whole Central European banking system, and then the whole house of cards came down. It hit London, and then you know, then it hit a, you know, Britain was forced with the gold standard, and then in October 1931, it just hit Wall Street with a vengeance. The Fed had to raise rates twice in 1 week, tipped the American banking system into the second leg of collapse, and we all know the rest. And 32 was the cruelest year. And
Ambrose, there's one big difference, though. You know what the difference is, in my opinion? First of all, this is very. I think this is a fascinating discussion that really would take more time to go through. But this whole, there wasn't CDS back then. There wasn't these credit default swaps back then. I think that the reason why, obviously, that there was never, you know, the fear, the horror, the absolute intent on making sure that any haircut was not considered a default or a trigger. For it was all about the CDS because the CDS exposure is enormous, which then, of course, minimize the whole point of having a CDS to back up your debt, right? But
well, I mean, you know, they went to huge lengths on Greece to prevent this triggering a formal, you know, CDS default. There's a big debate about this. I mean, in my opinion, that the CDS should have been allowed to trigger. They're interfering with contract law.
I agree.
But it's actually backfired on Europe because basically people who bought the CDS contracts were the holders of the Greek debt.
Right.
All these European banks who got in tizzy and the bears, you know, they bought protection. So they thought they were buying insurance against their holdings. And suddenly...
well, they're not going out now and buying new stuff because they can't back it up and insure it. That's
exactly
the whole point.
Exactly. Now they know that they can't, if they buy Spanish, supposing they go up to the next auction and buy Spanish debt and do their bit to sort of stabilize the Eurozone system, they can't buy the CDS contracts and spread the risk around the world to insure it and hedge it.
Right.
So it makes them less likely to buy the debt.
Yeah, I know. That's so stupid. So stupid. Really.
It's just... the thing is, if you follow the political debates here, you know, in the European Parliament, they're always, you know, and in the German Bundestag, people, especially in France, they're just screaming about CDS. The whole thing is caused by CDS. But somehow the speculators are using CDS to destroy the Euro project. It's an Anglo-Saxon conspiracy.
Ugh.
And it's all hatched somewhere in New York and London, probably, and get together. And we're going to destroy the euro with CDS. And this is what they think. And there are enough people who think this that it's become a political sort of issue and it's got traction. And you know, my suspicion is, and the general suspicion is, the data is not transparent, so we don't know. Is that actually it's British and European banks have underwritten quite a lot of those CDS contracts, so they're the ones on the hook.
Yeah, but you know what else? I think this is I'm about to put out a very insane theory. Okay, I believe that there could be a lot of CDS actually written by some of the governments through whatever means they did, because they know that they're not going to let anything default. Think about that. What a beautiful thing! It's like a cover. It's like selling a call against a stock that you know the stock's never. You get to monitor where the stock moves. So the call is, you know, you just get the premium in all the time. So the CDS that they wrote on some of the debt out there, they didn't want it to default, so they can control whether it defaults or not. Insane, like I said, but there's a theory.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I think that what we do pretty much know is that some of the German bank and some French financial entities and so forth, they wrote quite a lot of this stuff too. And they, you know, some of the German exposure is now in the hands of the German state,
mm-hmm.
because it was a Hyperforeign bank, and it's in part of their bad bank structure now. So mm-hmm. It's fallen into the hands of the state, and they hold the effect of the German government holds these CDS positions.
Right.
So if the Greek thing had been triggered, it would have suddenly cost quite a lot of money.
That's what I mean.
I mean, not systemically. I mean, it would have been politically very difficult for them to explain
right,
to their
right.
citizens. And so, and in France, it would have been also, you know, quite large sums of money. So I think they wanted to prevent that just being triggered as a further, further complication.
Right. So they just once again kick it down the road sometime. But what they do is it has backfire on them because they really, as you said, mess with contract law and really, in the end of the day. The only thing that holds financial markets together is, however, to whatever degree, confidence in something, confidence in agreement, a handshake, a law. And you lose that confidence and you lose the ability to have any kind of confidence in your analysis, your insurance, your understanding of markets, the flow of it, the liquidity, whatever it is, you're out. You're not putting your money into a vat.
I think there's often a false lesson drawn from the Lehman collapse, and I was talking to Myron Scholes about this. You know, he's the Nobel Prize winner. He got LTCM and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
He got the Nobel Prize for his work on derivatives. So he's a great derivatives theorist. His argument on Lehman was not, you know, obviously it should have been allowed to go bust. It wasn't an issue of whether you save it or not save it. It was the exact way in which it went bust. He said the problem was they should have, you know, at least for a week or a couple of weeks or something, suspended the bankruptcy laws. Bought time for everybody to net out and settle their accounts.
Right.
And they didn't. They just did it over a weekend, and everybody, and suddenly it all went haywire. Everybody was just sort of catastrophically having to sell things, in sort of cascade selling simultaneously as people had to meet margin requirements and so forth, and meet these obligations. And so if you could avoid that, if you had, supposing you had a sovereign debt, supposing you had a CDS, trigger on Italian debt. It'd be quite a large sum of money. I think it's about 380 billion nominal or something. Mm-hmm. That's quite a lot of money. Now a lot of this is going to net out, but you've got to give them time to sort that out. If you just let that go cold, and you know over a weekend, you know you drop that neutron bomb on the financial system,
right.
You're going to have another Lehman, obviously.
And by the way, whoever picked this whole weekend thing where you can't get into the markets and do something, and you have to panic about your positions until a market opens. This whole weekend shenanigans is gotten out of hand.
Well, it's ridiculous. You know, when you've got a situation like that, the big boys need to step in and simply take over, on a very temporary basis, you just impose some controls and you say, we're going to buy time for people to sort this out. And then we can figure out what the damage is, what the real damage is. Because a lot of this stuff nets out and then the actual damage left is not nearly so serious. It would be serious, and it might be enough to knock out some banks. But so long as it's controlled and somebody's in charge and they're not letting it just sort of spiral out of control in complete sort of panic, it's manageable.
Yeah. But when you find that person, let me know.
I think they've learned quite a lot from... And by the way, let me add, that the American handling of everything went wrong in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, it doesn't look so bad.
Well, no, it doesn't look so bad. I mean, yeah, because it looked like it got handled for some time, but really, who knows what the effects and the waves of all that were? And by the way, economists and I think the whole financial system, and that includes advisors, economists, and journalists, and we need to kind of get our crap together because this whole. Do you remember when the Japanese tsunami came and all that? And all the economists said there'll be no global effect on global growth due to this. Remember that? And I'm thinking to myself, are they out of their minds? What, how could they even say something like that? You know, that there'll be no global effect by the Middle East uprisings and oil hitting over 100. I'm thinking, how are they saying that? I don't if $100 oil when it was 80 doesn't affect the economy, then...
Yeah.
Then what's the point of even tracking the price of oil?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, oil, you can go up a certain point, and then you hit a threshold, and it suddenly starts really triggering.
It's
very difficult. Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Economists are just, we'll fix it, though. Ambrose Evans Pritchard of, is that right? Pritchard, right? Yeah.
That's right.
The Daily Telegraph writer, and if you want to find out how America and China must crush Germany into submission, or Spain being the fifth victim to fall in the Arctic Depression, or maybe even who the next leader is going to be ousted over there, which there's probably a list that we could think of. You check that out. This is a great, great time with you. I appreciate your time and your experience and your insight into all this.
It was a great pleasure.
I'll see you soon. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, well, we finish up with that segment of the show, and I think that we covered a lot, lots that are, I think that you're going to have to really sit back and maybe even, I dare say, play this again, because this was one of those, I think, insights that I had on what's going on in Europe that really, I think, clarifies a lot of things that may be in, out there in different parts that were just floating around. And I think that from what, at least the last number of minutes that I heard, Ambrose really put it together in a way that I think was very, very usable. And it's kind of scary. I mean, really, the fact is that it's kind of spooky-dookie what's going on out there with Europe and how things are really being handled. Well, with that, we're going to wrap it up today, and I hope you are here to join me next week. Make sure to tell some friends. Make sure to do me a favor and go over to iTunes. Put a review up there for me. I'd appreciate it. You know, type in a few words, what you think, what you expected, what you hope for, and, you know, we learn a lot from those. And, of course, if you are interested in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, where we can, you know, do some trading, we can buy and sell, we can hold, we can use options, we can go short, we can do a lot of things that you probably wanted to do but haven't really wanted to enough to really do it. But that's what we do inside the portfolio, have transparency for you, as well as a client private blog or a private client blog that gives you access to a lot of our thinking, the things that we're doing, and some things that are really just essentially all about your portfolio in particular. But, you know, this is a great way for you, if you don't know, to also do a lot of learning, because you kind of learn along with what we're doing. And it's all live in real time. So all you have to do is go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check that out. I really hope you do, because there's a 12 or so minute video that will give you a walkthrough, a virtual tour of what we do. So whether it's the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, $50,000 minimum, or the global allocations that we do, which have a $500,000 minimum, I think, you know, we kind of, I just want to let you know that the new year is coming, time to maybe make some changes, and, well, here we are. With that in mind, I want to thank you again for being here. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for following me on Twitter. That's Andrew Horowitz. You can go over and find me on Facebook as well, everywhere, you know. But make sure, do me a favor, just for that holiday season, tell a friend about, hey, I listened to this podcast and I learned so-and-so, or, you know, listen to this one, I really like this podcast, and give them a link. Maybe they'll start listening and become part of the family. I hope you have a great holiday. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and I wish you a wonderful week ahead. We'll have some more ideas coming to you and some things that you need to do by the end of the year. Again, thanks for joining me. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.